Today I'll be speaking with Catherine Butler, who is Reader in English at Cardiff University, has written extensively on fantasy literature, perhaps most notably with her monograph for British Fantasists in 2006, and has also written six fantasy novels herself. Thank you for joining me, Catherine.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So my first question to you is quite a general one. Hopefully it will take us down some interesting routes.
Sure.
This talk is part of a series grouped around the title Fantasy Literature. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is such a thing at all? And if so, how would you define it and what would be its main characteristics?
Well, I'm fairly sure there is such a thing. I think probably most literature historically has been fantasy literature. How we might define it is a trickier question. On the whole, that's one I'd rather leave to the lexicographers. I quite like the approach that Brian Atterbury took of defining fantasy in terms of it being a so-called fuzzy set, this kind of logical idea where things at the centre of the set are clear-cut. Everybody pretty much would agree that The Lord of the Rings is a fantasy work. Mm-hmm. But around the edges, well, it gets fuzzier, and there are borders between fantasy and science fiction, between fantasy and realism, between fantasy and magical realism, and various other genres. And there are certain texts that we might want to argue the toss. But I think if we get het up on those hard cases, we'll make some very bad law. Mm-hmm. If I had to choose amongst the many definitions of fantasy that have been offered, probably my favourite concise one is Catherine Hume's idea, and I'm probably slightly misquoting her here, that fantasy is that which differs from consensus reality. So, the phrase consensus reality, and particularly the word consensus, is the key one here, I think, because it suggests that what constitutes fantasy literature is partly a function of what people tend to think constitutes the real, which of course does vary over time and between cultures. Mm-hmm. And I think, yes, fantasy in that sense is a kind of moving target. And I think it also reminds us that phrase consensus reality, that reality is also up for negotiation, that when people contrast fantasy with the real that they're talking about is often in very large part a kind of social reality made up with things like promises, appointments, promotions, status, mm-hmm. market value, those kinds of concepts, which are in a sense just as fantastic as anything else. They are produced by the performative power of words rather than having any foundation in physics. And I think that actually as human beings we spend a lot of our lives in this problematic foreshore where imagination and physics have rival claims, and fantasy literature for me is interesting because it takes that dispute, if you like, as its subject matter. But I think it's implicit in almost all literature, in fact. Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you. If I might sort of ask a question on the back of that, sort of trying to address the main characteristics, in scare quotes, of fantasy literature.
Yes.
If it's even possible to tease out main characteristics, because I'm sure there will always be counterexamples where those main characteristics are not present and yet we would still call a work fantasy.
Almost certainly.
To take it back to Tolkien, he was, of course, hung up on this idea of fairy, diuresis over the and do you think that he was tapping into something at the core of fantasy in his notion of fairy, the fairy world? Is this a useful concept decades down the line to engage with?
I'm not sure it's a useful word. Mm-hmm. But then of course it's always a bad idea to call fairies fairies. Mm-hmm. They don't like it. think it does acknowledge something which, in the world of the fantasy that we call realism, we are likely to want to leave unacknowledged, which is that we are largely imaginative beings. We spend a good portion of our lives in the thrall of the subconscious. A third of our lives we're spending asleep. A lot of our waking hours we're spending in daydreams. A lot of our motivations are based on imagination and what we might call fantasy in a negative way as well as in a positive. So if we think about fairy as something which has power over our perceptions of reality, a kind of glamour, to use a good fairy word, I think it's something which absolutely is or needs to be written about. I'm not sure if that's what Tolkien had in mind by the word. Of course, he also, was it of fairy stories that he was writing, that he was defending that word? Of course, he also talks about that special kind of consciousness which we call subcreation.
Yes.
Which has tended to be linked, for understandable reasons, considering what his own fictions were like, with the idea of fairy, with the idea of the fantastic, and specifically with the idea of secondary worlds. But I think actually, if you go back and read that, originally a lecture, later an essay, you'll see that what Tolkien is talking about is actually that special state of half-hypnotic consciousness, which is called entering into a story. That story does not need to be what we would necessarily call a fantasy in the literary genre sense. If you read and are absorbed by Pride and Prejudice, if you fall in love with Mr. Darcy, or if you cry over the death of a favourite character, then in a sense you are being sucked into a subcreation. You're submitting your consciousness and your imagination to a belle dame sans merci, if I can say, in the form of an author, and that is a real power. We might call that fairy, we might call it something else, but I think perhaps we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in that same lecture, come essay, Tolkien talks about, where he uses Coleridge's term, the willing suspension of disbelief.
Yes, and I think it's the same thing.
He sort of argues against that up until the point and sort of suggests that a good fantasy should be able to ditch the word willing.
But yes, I do totally agree with him.
In that it should be an involuntary thing, and as soon as you become conscious of the fact that you're suspending disbelief, the magic of that experience is lost or diminished somehow.
Of course, he's quite right about that, and I suspect that Coleridge would have agreed with him if Tolkien had been able to pull him up on it. Yes, it's the suspension of disbelief more than the willingness, which is the key factor. But I think Tolkien was actually saying something quite important there, and something which in a way goes against the grain of English criticism as a kind of academic subject, where we've wanted on the whole to sit, as it were, in charge of all our faculties in some kind of evaluative or analytical judgment on a piece of literature and say, either describe it or evaluate it. And in order to do that, it requires a certain objective detachment from it. But literary experience at its best, I think, and certainly at its most involving, requires a kind of submission. Now, whether that submission is wholly voluntary, wholly involuntary, or somewhere in between, I think that varies. But the fact that it does get submitted to some extent is important, and without it, we wouldn't have any kind of effective relationship with stories or their characters or their places.
Great. So taking Tolkien as a starting point for my next question, and moving away from sort of the theoretical concerns of fantasy literature, there is the term Oxford School, which I understand is a term, a label that you've engaged with.
Well, I haven't actually engaged with that phrase. Mm-hmm. I think that's very much Maria's phrase, but I've certainly engaged with the phenomenon.
The phenomenon, precisely.
Because I think you're alluding, of course, to Four British Fantasists, where I took as my subject Alan Garner and Penelope Lively, but also two of the people in the so-called Oxford School, mm-hmm. Diana Wynne-Jones and Susan Cooper.
Yeah.
And part of the lens through which I was looking at them was the fact that they were all at Oxford as undergraduates in the first half of the 1950s. Only two of my four were studying English. Lively was studying history and Garner classics, mm-hmm. although he often did attend English lectures.
Yeah.
So yes, the Oxford School, it's a complicated and multi-part question, I think. There are some ways, I suppose I better start with a couple of caveats. I think
Go ahead.
If we want to talk about the Oxford School, we have to be aware that, as when we make any kind of label like that, there's a possibility of cutting out of the account other very important aspects of these writers' lives. So in the case of Diana Wynne-Jones, for example, the influence, acknowledged and I think pretty obvious, of E. Nesbitt on her writing. Well, E. Nesbitt's not an Oxford person and therefore won't appear in accounts of the Oxford School, but mm-hmm. certainly at least as much of an influence on Diana Wynne-Jones's C.S. Lewis, I should say. Mm. But that is to say, they were both influences, but let's not forget that Nesbitt was there too. Similarly with Susan Cooper, I think if you sit down and read The Dark is Rising alongside John Masefield's Box of Delights, you'll see that there's a very strong and direct connection there, mm-hmm. but again, that doesn't seem to fit. It's not that she doesn't belong in the Oxford School, but that her membership of it shouldn't be allowed to cut those other influences and aspects of her writing out of account. So there's that. The word school also perhaps suggests that there's a kind of conscious association of these
right.
people, that they were, as it were, working together. When I was writing my book, I jocularly, I think that would be the right word in these circumstances, suggested, was there a junior Inklings club where these writers got together and read each other early drafts of The Weird Stone of Brisingamen? Well, the fact is there wasn't. Mm. They, when they were at Oxford, none of these writers really knew each other, or certainly not at all well.
Yeah.
But having said all that, I think there are quite a lot of things for the idea of the Oxford School. One of them is Oxford itself. I think Philip Pullman's written quite eloquently on Oxford as a place.
Absolutely.
And when you think about the characteristics of so-called Oxford School fantasy, Oxford physically embodies quite a lot of them, with its history, obviously, also its traditions, its secrets, its hidden panels, as it were, its rituals, its shibboleths. Mm. And when you remember that these writers are coming here at the age of 18, most of them not having been to public schooling, and these are mostly grammar school people coming to Oxford
right.
for the first time at 18, a very impressionable age, having been told, no doubt, that by going to Oxford they are entering an intellectual and possibly social elite, which of course is kind of true in Britain.
Mm.
Well, then it wouldn't be terribly surprising if that would be an element of their thinking. And if we look at those kinds of ideas as they play themselves out in fantasy, why, lo and behold, they are there. So I think Oxford as a place is important. Another aspect, which of course Maria talks about in her book as well, is C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, the kind of founder members of the Oxford School. And yeah, certainly both as the kind of manufacturers and sponsors of the Oxford English curriculum with its heavily medievalist emphasis, and as exemplars of fantasy writers themselves, they were hugely influential, and I think that has been acknowledged by most of the writers in the Oxford School, and to some extent, perhaps not so much by Garner and Lively. Garner perhaps has, on the contrary, kind of denied influence. Then I think perhaps at least as important as that, though, has been the way in which Lewis and Tolkien have created both a market, you know, kind of literary market for fantasy, which later writers were then able to exploit.
Certainly in the case of Alan Garner, who I understand was encouraged to write and publish The Weird Stone of Brisingham, and because it was riding on the back of this kind of Tolkien mania.
Well, Billy Collins, who had rejected The Lord of the Rings before he received The Weird Stone of Brisingham, and having realised that he'd thrown away a pearl richer than all his tribe when he saw something else with wizards and dwarves. Dwarfs. He snapped it up, and certainly other people, including C.S. Lewis, when he read The Weird Stone of Brisingham, was immediately reminded of Tolkien, and he was not the last, obviously. Garner himself suggested that the resemblance was because they shared common sources. In Beowulf and so on. That argument rages. I'm not going to get involved in it. So there was the question of creating a market, and also very much connectedly a context of reception. So Lewis being the first example of that. But when people look at these books, they will be primed, as it were, to see Oxford, Lewisian, Tolkienian connections. So I think this is a kind of circle, virtuous or vicious, according to taste, by which that Oxford School, its edges become ever sharper and clearer, and, as it were, self-confirming.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you for that answer. I wondered if we might just say a bit more about Alan Garner as a sort of possible outlier in the idea of the Oxford School, as somebody who read classics briefly before terminating his studies, and as somebody who has denied this this influence from Tolkien or any association with a so-called Oxford School. But it is interesting that he does riff on some of the same traditions as Tolkien. The Weird Stone of Brisingham is steeped in Norse mythology. And the Owl Service is very much saturated in medieval Welsh literature.
It is.
The mythological and so on. He draws on the Mabinogion quite explicitly. And yet his writing's very local. It's very rooted in place and in very particular places in the British Isles.
Yes, and in fact the Owl Service is itself an outlier within Garner's work, because all the rest of his work is basically set around Alderley Edge, where he grew up, and Cheshire.
And I wonder if this is a thread perhaps that runs through at least some of the writings of some of the members of the Oxford School and their associates. Tolkien, I think, was very sensitive to place.
Absolutely.
We start in the small and the cosy and the homely of the Shire before expanding out into the wider world. Garner clearly interested in place, and as you say, most of his writing is situated in the region of Old Liège. Susan Cooper in The Dark is Rising, she's situating the events of that novel in a particular part of England, you know, in a part of England that was familiar to her. Do you think that this is perhaps one of the ways in which the later Oxford fantasy writers did something perhaps a bit different with the medieval source material that they may have been drawing on at times?
Well, I think they were mostly very interested in place anyway, whether they were doing it through literary medieval models, but I think a lot of the writers, all of the writers pretty much that we've mentioned so far, have a very, I wouldn't call this so much a specifically Oxford School characteristic, although it's certainly very much there in the Oxford School, but a very, it's a British fantasy kind of trope, I think, to use place, it's historical, it's archaeological, it's folkloric, it's sometimes even its paleontological aspects, and to try to find resonances, to dig down, to stratify, to excavate those places. And I think there's a large section of British fantasy writing, including pretty much all the Oxford School, but not confined to it, which is, as well, to coin a phrase, you know, it's very palimpsestuous. I think that's the way.
A nice word.
I think that's very much the way that a lot of British fantasy, not all of it, but a lot of British fantasy works. It looks for places in their different aspects, and if you could say it's backward looking, or you could say it looks down into the ground, and of course if you're an archaeologist, those two things are the same, because as you dig down, you go back in time. And in a way, this is a distinction on the whole between British fantasy writing and that of, say, America, where of course there is a lot of history, but a lot of it is off limits for writers of European descent, because for reasons of a very understandable cultural sensitivity. So when they write fantasy, they have to make it from different kinds of materials. So they might use some imported European elements, or they might try to make it out of contemporary elements. So something like Oz, I think, is doing both of those things. I'm not an expert on American fantasy, however, so I probably shouldn't go too far down that line.
But there's perhaps a tangible difference between what, for example, American fantasy writers are doing as opposed to what British fantasy writers have at least done historically, because of the different space that they occupy, that they live in. There is a different cultural context that's been considered.
Absolutely. And as I say, it doesn't apply to all British fantasy, but I think there's a lot of fantasy writers, some associated with Oxford, some no doubt influenced by Oxford people, like Rowling, for example. And there's a couple of Oxford writers that we haven't mentioned, such as Jill Peyton Walsh and Penelope Farmer, both fantasy writers who were at St. Anne's a couple of years after Diana Wynne Jones was there, overlapping a little bit.
So they're
writers who are, I think, in many cases, not in all their work, but in many cases, looking at the kind of archaeological aspects of Britain in the broadest sense and finding magic there. And I think it was Humphrey Carpenter who characterised, perhaps slightly caricatured, fantasy from, at any rate, the 60s and 70s as having a kind of recognisable pattern where, you know, often children will discover some artefact or some secret or some hidden place within a place, which opens up its historical or more likely magical or mythological past to them, And in understanding that, they will come to understand themselves. And in a way, you could say all of this is even reprising the kind of experience which was first set out in a book like Puck of Pook's Hill by Rudyard Kipling, where its exposure to the mythological past of England, which is then consciously forgotten but remains at the subconscious level, that really grounds the child protagonist in a sense of themselves as English in this particular case, very specifically.
Mm.
So I think in that sense, and of course Maria in her book is quite rightly connecting this to its imperialistic and nostalgic elements. I think in this sense you could say that strain of fantasy writing from Kipling on, and in a different direction coming from C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, had a very long tail. Perhaps we're not past it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want entirely to repudiate everything that's in that aspect of fantasy writing, but obviously there are many very problematic aspects to it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm glad that you sort of picked up on the response of children to fantasy literature and fantasy literature, which has perhaps intentionally got them in mind. Tolkien and Lewis grappled with this distinction between children's literature and adults' literature, specifically in the context of fantasy. Would you say that there is a clear divide between the two, or that there ought to be a divide if people try to enforce it?
I don't really know what that divide would be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just a matter of fantasy literature. On the whole, I'm rather puzzled by the attempt to put a very clear or hard border between childhood and adulthood in general. And even Philip Pullman, of course, subversive as mm-hmm. he is with regard to Lewis and Tolkien, and antipathetic as he is to them in many ways, in a sense with his conceit of the idea of the demon settling, puts a very hard distinction between what it is to be a child and what it is to be an adult.
Mm.
Whereas my experience is that the border, if there is one at all, is a good deal more messy than that. That it's a very gradual process, one which also includes a lot of regressions, and that we're talking about a graduated spectrum, if anything at all, rather than a border. So I wonder, though, you know, for whose benefit is this border perceived as being existent or important or necessary to be enforced? I've often thought that there are two contrary but equally deeply rooted ideas about childhood current in Western society. One is what we might call the Pauline school, you know, once you grow up you put away childish things.
Mm-hmm.
And this figures childhood as developmental, as something which is preparatory for adulthood often being identified with so-called real life. And in that sense, childhood and things connected to childhood, including, of course, children's literature, are necessarily seen as inferior or, at any rate, half-formed.
Mm.
But, of course, that coexists with a very different, indeed contrary model, which we might call the Rousseauian school, whereby children, in becoming adults, are losing as much as, if not more than, they're gaining. That children have some kind of insight or some kind of perception, some kind of understanding even, that adults do not have, and that in gaining knowledge or in gaining sophistication, in gaining social understanding, they're losing something more important, some connection with nature or something more spiritual, depending on which inflection you want to have. So children themselves, of course, are subject to both of these pressures, and anybody who has anything to do with children, including children's writers, are sort of pulled in these two directions as well. Mm. In my office at work, I have a New Yorker cartoon which shows some parents being shown around a nursery, and the teacher in charge of the nursery is saying, as she looks down at these 3 or 4 year old children, "We tried to teach them that the world can be a dangerous and unwelcoming place at times, and that they must be very careful to be safe. But at the same time, we're trying to preserve their lovely innocence. It's tricky." And I think these kinds of contradictory demands that we make on children, well, the fact that they're contradictory should make us suspicious in the first place, I guess. Why do we have these two very different ideas about children? And why are we so insistent that they must both be right? And how does this manifest in things that we say to children, or that we give to children in the form of literature about, you know, how they should be thinking of themselves and of their futures? So, in order to answer your question, I don't put any hard distinction between children's fantasy and adult fantasy. Of course, there are some things that children probably wouldn't find very interesting or easily understood, that adults can know about and have experienced. And probably if you did a fantasy about the menopause, it wouldn't set a lot to children, for example. But beyond that, I don't really see any particular problem with letting everybody find their own level and find what they like.
Mm-hmm. And to sort of conclude on this point, this is something that Pullman has written about outside of his own fantasy novels. Mm. I wonder whether you think that the settling of demons in his Dark Materials is itself a critique of a society which has this paradoxical relationship towards children. He said that children should be encouraged to read just about anything that might appeal to them, whether it's specifically intended for them or not.
Well, I quite agree with him about that. I think in Pullman's case, and I may be doing him an injustice here, but if we put it in the terms I was a minute ago, his sympathy is, I think, very much with the kind of developmental side. So, you know, for him, the so-called fall is actually a felix culpa, isn't it? It's so yes, in Pullman's case, he's often recommended the essay On the Marionette Theatre, which tries to explain how we must, as it were, lose childish innocence in order to return to something like it through the back door of Eden, as it were, at the end. But in order to get there, you must pass through experience, including sexual experience, of course. So he's definitely critiquing, I should say, the kind of Rousseauian idea of children being holy, or whatever word you want to apply. I slightly part company with him in the sense that the way in which he critiques it is to some extent simply to invert it. So rather than saying, you know, childhood is good and adulthood is a kind of degeneracy, we're saying that, you know, childhood is inadequate and adulthood becomes a kind of perfection. And I don't think you need to invert it in order to critique it. I think you can abolish it.
I think that's quite a nice note for us to finish on. I think that we're out of time. Catherine Butler, thank you very much for your time and for your very thoughtful responses.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.